Hello, everyone. Welcome to Powering Up. This is a cross-generational, cross-cultural conversation about female power, what it looks like, why it's important, and what we can all do to claim our power and put it to work, individually and collectively. I'm Ann Doyle, your host and author of Powering Up, How America's Women Achievers Become Leaders, and also a seasoned cultural boat rocker. Now, my co-host here is millennial Monica Doyle, and if you notice that we have the same last name, that's because, yep, Monica's my niece. So tell us a little bit about you, Monica.
I have kind of been taking inspiration from a lot of your, like, lady power things since I was a little girl.
Oh, I love that.
And I kind of like to think that I'm sort of bringing a little bit of the, a bit more millennial generation
into it. Right, which we want in this conversation. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But just tell people a couple quick things about your background now in terms of your education, your interests.
I am a digital cinema major. I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in cinema and art. And I am a ice hockey instructor.
Very cool. Yeah. So I just wanted to set this up by saying that, you know, the idea for this podcast actually came from my millennial son, Kevin, who's 26 right now. And he observed me starting to work on my second book, which was really about engaging men as gender allies, which is a really great topic, too.
Important.
But Kevin told me for a couple of years, he said, forget about writing another book, Mom. You need to do a podcast. And I'm like, podcast, modcast, what's a podcast? I never listened to those. And he said, yeah, that's because you're old. So I finally started listening to Kevin and to podcasts, and he was absolutely right, because podcasts are where it's at these days, and particularly in terms of this next generation of millennials that I really want to hear from, talk with, reach out to. What's your idea about this podcast, Monica?
Well, I kind of started off thinking it was just going to be like a review of your book, but the more we work on it, the more I think it's kind of about current things happening in the world, you know, discussing those things in relation to the idea of powering up.
Right.
And I've kind of started finding inspiration all around me, you know, of new things to do, new things to talk about. So it's been pretty fun.
And I know you just got back from Rome.
Yep.
So you bring not
Italy.
Only, you know, we're based in Detroit, but we've traveled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a global perspective. We're open-minded, and we're not afraid to have some courageous conversations here on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to start today with another rabble-rouser who's all about courageous conversations. We have a fascinating guest with us. Her name is Rabbi Tamara Colton. Now, before you start conjuring up images of old guys in long beards, I want to say that she is the coolest rabbi you are ever
That's
going
awesome.
To meet. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, Ann.
Welcome. You know, Tamara is also incredibly young to be the first person ever ordained as a
humanist rabbi.
As a humanist rabbi, which was recognized by the New York Times back in 1999. So she's lived in Israel, she's married to an Israeli, she speaks Hebrew, and it was fascinating. You even wrote your doctoral dissertation on the experience of being a woman rabbi.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So we're going to talk about that. But these days, just a little bit more about Tamara before we get going in this conversation. She practices Judaism from a feminist perspective with a bit of a Buddhist touch, right? And she's also working on her upcoming book, Oranges
yes.
for Eve. And she's also a sought-after rabbi for interfaith couples. Now, most recently, Tamara wrote an article tracing the whole hashtag MeToo movement back to Eve
mm-hmm.
and the Bible. And it was pretty controversial.
Yes.
Lots to talk about there. So welcome,
Thank
Tamara,
you.
Rabbi Tamara Colton.
I'm the luckiest rabbi to be here with you, Anne, and with you here, Monica.
Well, let's get right into this this article, which we will post it. It's posted, definitely be posted on Powering Up Facebook page and with this. But what was the gist of your message about that article, and why was it so controversial?
I was watching on the news these gymnasts testify. We all remember that several months ago at the Larry Nassar hearing. And I started crying. I mean, I started weeping. I was so moved by their bravery.
These little girls, very young.
Little girls, and also powerful women who had mastered their physical power, but were fighting so hard to call back their spiritual power, which had been lost, which had been stolen by this predator doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And one after the other, it was this collective spiritual bravery. You know, the Me Too movement started as a movement to name predators.
Mm-hmm.
But it has taken on a spiritual dimension, because whenever we stand against the silence and we say, I have a right to be loved, mm-hmm. and to live my best life, and anything that is not of love, meaning shame and silence, I will no longer hold. And to speak this in a courtroom, because they weren't embraced at first.
It wasn't like the news came
and the Me Too movement came and they all held them and said, we're behind you, nothing bad's going to happen. I mean, they had to face the total disintegration of their lives to tell this story. And a child that has been molested is a child that has had to drink the worst kind of poison. And to be able to come forward and then to stand with other women, which is what's so beautiful, is we give each other
a sisterhood
power.
Of that. Tell us about what that prompted you to write in terms of this article.
So I'm watching this and thinking, for the grace of God, I have not experienced any of this kind of trauma as me, Tamara, but we all have experienced this, men and women, men too, but particularly women in a patriarchal culture. And I'm trying to think about, how is it possible that this still goes on? How is it possible for so many years that he was able to do this?
Mm-hmm.
What contributes to a culture that enables this kind of sickness and silence? Because I know many people knew.
I know, but you got to tell us about this article.
Well, I think it all starts with Eve. Eve is the symbol. She is the patriarchal, mythological symbol.
What do you mean by that?
Because here we have in this sacred book, the Bible, in Judaism, it's the Torah. It's the first book of the five books of Moses. We kiss, we pray to this document, we parade it, we hold it as the word of God. And it's a mythology that tells of the shaming and silence and abuse of a woman. It's the
in
first
the Garden
story.
Of Eden you're talking about.
All mm-hmm. Eve does is eat a piece of fruit. She listens to her inner voice. She's actually the first heroine. And then, boom, she's punished. And her punishment, the first feeling is shame. Shame for her body, because how does God know that she did it? She's covering herself up with a fig leaf. So women here are being told, you are shameful.
And this is through thousands of years is what you're talking about.
And now we have the story, yes, that every Sunday school kid knows. I mean, you don't have to be religious. Everyone knows. It's a collective mindset that somehow I'm bad as a woman. I did something wrong and I am bad. And I think every little girl grows up with a seed of Eve in her. And it allows us, what it does is it like contributes to, it germinates to this other garden of shame. It keeps us silent. And we somehow at a deep level believe that whatever bad has happened to us, especially the sick bad stuff, like molesting a girl's body. We deserved it.
And so you wrote this in this article.
So I wrote this.
And I imagine that was incredibly controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I even wrote that God was the first predator of body shaming.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I actually wrote sexual assault, but my 13-year-old daughter had a talk with me on the way home from school and told me that I needed to turn it down. And it wasn't sexual assault. It was body shaming.
This is why this cross-generational conversation is important.
Well, and that's a hot phrase to people nowadays is body shaming.
Yeah.
As well, you know, like, why did she get raped? Well, because she was wearing scanty clothes, you know, walking down the street. It was her body. Stuff
it's her fault.
Yep.
Exactly. So that's the myth that I took on. You know, myths can be more true than nonfiction. This myth has been held as true. A woman, if she's raped, she deserved it. What was she wearing? I mean, that's the Jodie Foster movie, right? That's that's the accused, right?
Yep.
She deserved it. And ultimately, when you go back, well, what was she doing? What was she doing? Well, she was born a girl.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what did girls do? Girls are descendant from Eve. And what did Eve do? Eve ruined everything for men.
Wow, this is really powerful stuff. So, Monica, when you read the article and when you hear Tamara talk about this, what's your reaction?
Well, my first reaction was that it should be like a video. Like, I thought of all of this imagery, all of this artistic imagery that goes along with it. And I just got back from my trip to Italy, and we were in Rome, Florence, Venice. And there's all of this imagery of Eve in particular. It's all difficult to look at. Most of it is. And so
you
reading
mean in,
the article,
in the paintings, I
in the
mean
paintings.
All the, and the statues, I mean,
yeah,
everywhere, right?
Well, and in the Renaissance, there was like this huge emphasis on like expressing these things that you want to look away from, you know, and there was a lot of that put into Eve in particular, like the comparison of a painting of Adam and Eve. Eve was always like the much more, she always had this look of agony on her face, mm-hmm. whereas Adam was like, well, darn, I'm along for the ride. And so,
or hers was guilt, maybe.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Hers, shame,
but she's the one that bared the brunt of the whole concept of fault. You know, Adam was just like, oh well, she. I mean, there's even pictures
not
of
my
Adam
fault,
pointing,
it was her.
Yeah, at her. You know,
she made me do it.
Yeah,
whatever
putting
I
the blame.
Did, she made me do it.
Yeah, why did I rape her? She made me do it. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. And so when I first read the article, I hadn't been to Italy at that point, but I thought of all of these images. And I thought of like making it into a video of like showing these images alongside your words and alongside mm-hmm. these ideas that honestly I had thought before, but never really thought to like write about. So I thought it was really interesting to read that in your paper, especially from your religious perspective.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at a picture that was put by the Free Press alongside the article when it was published.
That's the Detroit Free Press you're talking about.
The Detroit Free Press. And it's the Creation of Eve by Michelangelo. And he painted it in 1772. And Eve is begging, floating in the air like an angel. So she's between a human state and an angelic state. And she's begging, she's supplicating for her life back.
Mm. Wow. Well, you know, in this article, one of the things that many things you wrote jumped out at me, and I'm going to quote you here. You wrote, "This God, this man-made figurehead of the patriarchy is not my God. He is a fiction, a myth, but yet one so powerful that it has poisoned and limited our notion of what God, the truly divine, is and can be, especially for women." That is really daring stuff. But what's your image of what God can be for women?
The closest that I have now, my image is evolving. I was ordained a humanistic rabbi, which is a whole other story, which is essentially an atheist congregation, a little group of rebel Jews. And I left there because my image, my belief and understanding of God was real and evolving. And where it is today is the feminine divine. Like a mother, whatever a mother would want for her children, That's not to say that the feminine isn't in men, but the masculine is different than the feminine energy. We're not talking about gender. We're mm-hmm. talking about energy. Mm. Feminine energy says, all I want is for my children to have a good life. I would never punish them into shame and silence. I would never take my children from a state of grace to shame. Mm-hmm. What I would do, though, it's the healing of the feminine. I would take my child, we are all the children of God, from shame back to grace. And that's the role of the divine today, and that's what I want from my God. I want to have all the shame loved out of me. And I want to live every day more and more into grace, which I think is the birthright of every human being.
So how do we do that? I mean, we have thousands of years
That's right.
of this myth, of this patriarchy, of this degrading, shaming of women. So here we are, early 21st century, talking about it. How do we move the needle forward in a new direction?
Well, we are doing it. That's what Me Too is. That's what this all these collective movements, this youth movement against gun violence, against automatic machine guns, really, not against guns. We are doing it. What is an incredible role model in our time are the truth and reconciliation hearings that were held in South Africa. And that's what I liken the energy of what Me Too is doing. First, we have to be able to bear witness and to listen to the testimony around us.
Remind anybody who's listening what those truth and reconciliation hearings were about in South Africa after the end of apartheid.
Correct. The truth and reconciliation hearings went over a period of 7 years when anyone who was harmed could come forward and tell their story.
Publicly.
Publicly. And this was the healing power. When you break the silence and other people are willing to bear witness to the truth, we begin to heal. And that entire country, can you imagine coming from the darkest into the light? From the silence and the absence of light to the exposure. It's like what light does for a plant. You take a plant from the dark into the light, and you give it a little bit of love and nourishment, and it grows. So it's not that complicated. It's a natural tendency to heal. So as we come together, and women are leading the way, that's what the Dalai Lama said.
And it's young women, it's young women who are leading the way.
The Dalai Lama stood up at a conference for Western women and said, Western women will save the world.
Well, we better get started.
You're doing it, Anne.
I don't know about me, but I'm counting on your generation. Monica, jump in here. I mean, what are you thinking about in terms of this? I mean, do you feel the weight of us saying, come on, young women, get going?
I mean, I feel like my generation has tried to put their foot in the ring, but even beyond that, the younger generation, the one just below me, these...
Gen Z. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these kids who are part of the Never Again movement.
Right.
You know, and they have these people in the news like David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez.
They're amazing.
And I've listened to David Hogg's things, and they're interesting. He does seem to have this bile to him, though, whereas Emma Gonzalez seems to have more of a graceful approach to some of these things. You know, they're all angry and they all deserve to be, but I love watching Emma Gonzalez mm-hmm. speak, mm-hmm. you know, because she's just demanding a change that, you know, needed to come a long time ago that they weren't the first ones to talk about. You know, part of the movement was when they went for their march, the March for Our Lives, you know, they even lifted up the African-American students who fought for the same thing but weren't heard.
Yes.
You know, they tried to give them the spotlight that they deserved when these tragedies happened to them, too.
Yes.
So I think my generation has worked on it, but this generation just below mine is, or above mine, perhaps.
Well, they're going to push you.
Yeah.
Because they're right on your heels. They're hot on
your heels. At this point, they've taken the reins and they're leading the horse.
You know, a thing about Emma Gonzalez also in terms of this female spiritual power is that she puts a very different visual image out there.
That's right.
Of what feminine leadership looks like.
Yes.
I've had a little bit of difficulty with the fact that everybody's talking about her look, like her hair in particular.
Well, they do that about women.
They do. And I even read an article that was in favor of these kids the other day, and they cannot mention her without talking
about
her.
That's so fascinating.
Well, they couldn't mention Hillary without talking about you know, what she was wearing. I mean, this isn't just Emma Gonzalez.
Right.
Her look is a little different.
It's true.
But it's so classic.
But it drives me nuts. It's like, why does it matter? And I even went online and looked up why she shaved her head, and her reasoning was it's hot in Florida.
Which is a great reason.
That's a good
reason. I don't have time to be messing with my hair.
I think this leads to another conversation, which is pushback, and how whenever we're breaking through, like an airplane is breaking through the sound barrier, you know, you hear that supersonic boom, you have to be willing to keep going after the boom. There is pushback, and there is a great wave of people that want to re-silence.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got a lot of that, didn't you? What happened to you?
I am very brave, but what I did not expect was the amount and level of hate that would come my way. I was warned.
Because of this article.
Yes, I was warned by Brian Dickerson, who is a Detroit Free Press editor and who is just an incredible, he's an incredible person. He said, well, the problem is when he first read this article is you'll become a lightning rod for radical voices, or I don't know if radical was his word, but angry voices. And I said to him, oh, that's fine. I've done that. I was a pulpit rabbi. But actually, I did not like it. It was tough for me.
It even surprised you, even though he warned you and you knew it was coming.
It surprised me because it scared me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I received many phone calls. Many people were calling my personal phone. It first started out because this was originally published in The Foreword. So I got...
What is that?
The Foreword's a Jewish publication. And so initially I got this, like, fundamentalist... hateful response from who I imagined were like more Orthodox Jews. I thought they were probably calling me from New York. But then it was published in the Free Press, and I naively put it on my Facebook page and didn't make my page private, which my brother later taught me, you know, Tam, you gotta like go in and fix it.
Yeah.
Then I got from the Christian fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then it was picked up by some guy. You know, every once in a while you can Google yourself and see what's going on. And he was doing this Debunking Me Too, this article by Rabbi Colton, which was so fascinating because I couldn't believe that that's all the material he had to talk about. And 114,000 people had listened to it.
Wow.
Which freaked my kids out. They were so freaked out that someone was going to come and, like, letter bomb us. That's a football stadium.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. So I think
you're going to raise your voice. You have to be ready for
it. That's right. That's right.
And, you know, I heard a quote, you know, somebody said, you know, if you're not getting a lot of angry pushback, then you're really not making a difference, right?
You're not doing it right.
Yeah. But wow. Is it scary? You know, and it is, and I don't like it, but this is what needs to be done. And everybody who was part of a change has to face the resistance and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you talk about the attacks that you've received, but in my experience, whenever like you take the time to say something that you know you're going to get backlash for, the thing that keeps you going is the support from friends and family and people who care about your message.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about, you know, it was fascinating to me that you wrote your dissertation, your PhD dissertation on the experience of being a female rabbi, and I'm curious about what changes you've noticed over the course of your career now. In the reaction to you as a female religious leader?
You know, I've been able to have such a full, great career as a woman rabbi, in part because great men have helped me along and opened many doors for me. women and men, but men really have held the establishment in Judaism.
Right, they still have the power everywhere.
And there's still times when a family will call the funeral chapel and say they want a rabbi, and the funeral director, who's one of my best friends, will suggest me, and they'll say, well, we really would prefer a man. But more so, there's people who are so happy to have a woman who will be nourishing and warm and not be dogmatic and have a big ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Well, I know you're working on a book, and which is entitled Oranges for Eve.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the book and maybe that title, which I think goes back to a story you told me about Seder plates. Is that right?
It does. There is an urban legend. It's not exactly correct, but it's understood as this is what happened by most people, that there was a statement made by a rabbi who did not think that women should be rabbis. Women have only been ordained rabbis by the seminaries, the more liberal seminaries, beginning in 1972. And there still are no women rabbis in Orthodox Judaism. And the statement he made was, a woman belongs on a bima, like an altar, like an orange belongs on a Seder plate. If you know what a Seder is.
Well, for those who don't, tell us what traditionally has belonged on a Seder plate.
Traditionally on a Seder plate are things that are dry, like matzah, and represent desert, like the mortar of the bricks that the Jews used to build the pyramids or whatever they were building in Egypt. Bitter herbs, like horseradish, to remind you of the bitterness of slavery. And then you get this piece of dry parsley that represents the spring, but nothing juicy. And so now what's happened, and it's all over the world, we are putting oranges on our Seder plates. So this big orange tropical piece of fruit, which is totally out of step with the desert, it suck up so much water, is in the middle of the Seder plate to say, yes, a woman belongs on the bima, a woman rabbi belongs on the bima. So this idea for the book is, what if we took all the poison apples, like Eve ate, all this poison from patriarchal mythology and culture that we have ingested, and we turned it to juicy, nourishing, sweet oranges, and the healing power of new stories and releasing all that shame into grace.
Hmm. Well, Monica, we could go on and on with this conversation. Let me give you the last question, the last word.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, I have been to a Seder before, and I love the idea of putting something juicy and delicious. I especially love the idea of taking something that a man says to put women down and turning it in your favor. Nasty woman, she was warned. And we take these things and we throw them back, and it's like, oh, okay, you want to say these disparaging things about us? Well, we're going to take it and we're going to turn it into our slogan, and we're still going to march against you. So I did not previously know that story about the oranges, although I have always liked the imagery of Eve and oranges in all of your writings that I've seen. But it was very refreshing to hear that story about the Seder plate. So thank you for that.
Oh, it's such a privilege.
Would you encourage other women to become spiritual leaders? I know that trend is growing, but it's still not easy.
We need women. We need women because women are half the population.
I think more than half right now, even, aren't they?
Even more, maybe.
A little bit.
Women have a role to return religion to spiritual practice. To return religion from rules and systems and organized patriarchal programs to divinely inspired communities where people can heal and experience great joy together.
And I know, it's not about driving men out.
No.
It's about us taking our equal place as voices in helping people to have a connection to God, whatever you call God.
And men will benefit.
Sure.
I mean, do men want to keep going to war and sending their sons to war? I mean, look at, and look at the Catholic Church and what happened with shame and silence. That okay. was mostly, there were boys. They were boys.
Right.
So it's not just for women. It's for all of us.
Right. Well, I always remember the words of my dad because when I was, first sort of paying attention to all these issues as a young woman, I mean, I was really like driven away from, I was raised an Irish Catholic, and, you know, to go in there and have all the language about God being he and all the songs about, you know, the sons of God and all that. I mean, it just was driving me away. And I remember my Notre Dame graduate Irish Catholic father said to me, Annie, don't let the church stand between you and God.
Oh, wow.
And that just freed me up yeah. to sort of get the Catholic Church and whatever it was at that time out of the way and opened me up to having a personal relationship with
yes.
God. Yeah. Well, we could go on and on. And Rabbi Tamara Colton, thank you for your courage.
Oh,
continue raising
you.
Your voice. We need you, and thanks for being with us. Anything else? Anything final you want to say?
Thank you, Anne. You are a way shower, a pioneer, and you give all of us power.
Wow. Well, thanks. Well, that's what this is about. This podcast is all about powering up. I mean, really, to share anything that I've learned over the years, and also to bring other powerful voices across generations, across genders, across everything, really. You know, we want to hear from you. Okay. So thank you for joining us, Rabbi Tamara Colton. Monica, thanks so much for being in here
thanks
with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Take a look at us on Facebook, Powering Up. Hope you'll subscribe to our podcast. Tell your friends about it. And next time, we're going to be talking about girls' hockey, which, believe it or not, is the fastest growing sport in the world. There are now three generations of women playing hockey in organized games and things. I'm so jealous of them because I'm a pre-Title IX tomboy who never had a chance. And Monica, you, I know, are a hockey coach. You were inspired, obviously, by the women, U.S. women who just won the Olympic gold medal in mm-hmm. hockey. And I know that you're putting together our podcast, which is going to include this very, very cool little six-year-old. Is that right?
I think she's six. She might even be a little older. She might be seven. But she impresses me daily with how willing she is to get out there, not only play with the boys, but knock them over.
With the total support of her dad, right?
Oh, yes, completely.
So we're going to be talking all about that. And I hope you'll tune us in again. And just a final thought, you know, remember the world is a very tough, competitive place, and it's happy to eliminate you from opportunity, from your power, or from achieving your dreams. But whatever you do, in the words of my fantastic father, never, ever eliminate yourself. We want to inspire you. We want to encourage you. We want to charge you up to find your power and put it to work. Go get them. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you'll subscribe and join me on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Doyle LDR or my website, Ann Doyle Leadership. And remember, power is the currency for getting things done. That's why getting comfortable with power is essential, and you're never too young or too seasoned to start. So let's go power up.